This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Kevin Seitz. His book is The Things They Cannot Say, Stories Soldiers Won't Tell You About, What They've Seen, Done, or Failed to Do in War. Also, William Bennett, he's a board member for the Americans for Strong Defense, a different William Bennett than the well-known commentator, by the way. This one served 12 years in the U.S. Air Force, and he is leading the charge with a group called Americans for Strong Defense against Chuck Hagel as defense secretary. We'll talk with him about why he believes that Chuck Hagel's not a good choice. And Jack German, the fabled commentator who began his career, in a way, right here in Baton Rouge, Baton Rouge High and LSU, 85 years old yesterday, and he will be with us to talk some politics. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. 877-217-5757. We begin with the fabled commentator, columnist, and writer of renown, Jack German, who has been writing about American politics almost since the day he left Baton Rouge High in 1945, and he celebrated a significant birthday yesterday. Happy birthday, Jack German.
Hi, thanks, Jim.
This one is 85?
85.
Does it seem like 68 years since you left Baton Rouge High School?
I don't know. I'm one of those people, if I'd known I was going to live this long, I'd take a better care of myself.
Well, I'm convinced that you and Hugh Hefner will be the last World War II veterans still standing.
That may be. That may be.
You're a man who has not lived a life of moderation. I've read through the years that usually when Jack German is cornered in a public place, there's some alcoholic libation involved.
It's been known to happen.
And occasionally go to the track.
Occasionally. I still go to the track, though.
Well, you followed politics a long time. You share your birthday with Franklin Delano Roosevelt. We've commented on this show in the last few weeks, the only presidents in your lifetime who have won two terms for president, two or more, with more than 51% of the votes, are Franklin Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower, and Barack Obama.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you explain the victory by Obama in such convincing fashion?
Well, a lot of it was that Mitt Romney was a terrible candidate. And he was, the more people saw him, the less they liked him. And they ran a very bad campaign. They alienated women voters. They alienated Latino voters. You know, they were sort of ignoring the demographics, which now they're trying to make up for. But he was just not a very good candidate.
297-5633 for Jack German, author of Fat Man Fed Up, Fat Man in a Middle Seat, columnist for several decades with Jules Whitcover, whose work still appears in the Baton Rouge Advocate. And of course, Jack German was a staple on the McLaughlin Group for many years as well. Story today, Governor Andrew Cuomo's approval rating has fallen sharply among New York voters since he pushed restrictive gun laws through the legislature. A poll shows his job performance down 15 points from his 74% approval rating last month. Do you make anything of this?
Yeah, what I make of that is that the 74% was always a pipe dream. I mean, no politician in a vigorously political two-party state can survive long at a 74% approval rating. You know, it just doesn't work. Governor Christie in New Jersey has a similar one right now, but it's not easy to maintain.
Well, Cuomo is apparently going to run for president, as are a few other governors, mainly Bobby Jindal in Louisiana, perhaps Chris Christie in New Jersey. We could have a plethora of governors on the national stage in 2016, Jack.
That's right. And Martin O'Malley of Maryland. Another one who was clearly interested in running for governor. Perhaps Jeb Bush, former governor of Florida. And there'll be a lot of governors. You know, when you get open seats, there's a lot of people come out of the underbrush.
Well, yesterday, the former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords testified on Capitol Hill and explained her reasons why she is in favor of gun rights being curtailed. We're talking about assault weapons. And, of course, a fiery retort from Wayne LaPierre of the NRA. This issue is one that is going to permeate for a while, isn't it?
Well, it's the same issue all the time. I mean, the NRA insists that this is any restrictions at all on guns is the first step down a slippery slope, which is not the case at all. And they've managed to frighten people into believing this, and it's a very important issue in a lot of states. I mean, I live in West Virginia now, outside of D.C., but in West Virginia, in this state, the gun issue is very big. And it doesn't work very well for the Democrats.
Well, it could be a big issue in 2014 in the congressional elections, no doubt, and in the U.S. Senate elections, one of which will feature Democrat Mary Landrieu trying to hold her seat against a Republican challenge, most likely led by Congressman Bill Cassidy of Baton Rouge.
Yeah.
Kevin, let's go to yesterday's hearing on Capitol Hill and hear from former Congresswoman Giffords, followed by Wayne LaPierre of the NRA.
Violence is a big problem. Too many children are dying. Too many children. We must do something. It will be hard, but the time is now. You must act. Be bold, be courageous. Americans are counting on you.
And Wayne LaPierre.
I think the national instant check system, the way it's working now, is a failure because this administration is not prosecuting the people that they catch. They're not, 23 states are not even putting the mental records of those adjudicated mentally incompetent of a system. Now, to assume that if you don't prosecute and they try to buy a gun, even if you catch them and you let them walk away, to assume they're not going to get a gun, they're criminals, they're homicidal maniacs, and they're mentally ill. I mean, we all know that homicidal maniacs, criminals, and the insane don't abide by the law.
All right, Jack. What do you think? Will this issue have any legs, or is it a non-starter?
It is no different than what it was, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 20 years ago. This issue does not change, and there are certain places in most states where a soft position on gun control is politically fatal, and there are a lot of other states where it is the opposite is true. It doesn't change much, really. How people would not be affected by Gabby Giffords, the former congresswoman, by her appearance the other day, is hard to believe, but in the long run, it won't make a bit of difference.
You don't think so?
No, I really don't. I mean, I think they will get a few minor pieces of legislation through, but they won't get a ban on assault weapons. The most they might get would be a ban on big magazines, you know, more than 10 shells. Now, that is possible, but that's about as far as it would go. And, of course, some kind of a souped-up or strengthened registration system. But I have very little confidence they will do anything that will cut down the number of guns available.
Well, there are already more than 300 million guns in the United States right now, so even if there were a ban, it would be hard to confiscate all the weapons that are still in our society.
It takes a long time to wear out that many guns.
Yeah. some would say lock up the ammo, that might be the solution. But guns are part of the culture, particularly here in the South. And you're in West Virginia, which is a southern state, kind of. And as you say, it's a political tough issue for any Democrat in West Virginia. Also, a place like Nevada, where Harry Reid.
It's not just the South. In Western Pennsylvania, for example, the gun issue is very virulent, very strong, no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
In parts of Michigan.
Well, we have few inquiries. The president's now almost 2 weeks into his second term. Often second terms are not the best. Second term of Clinton brought us Monica Lewinsky. Second term of Reagan brought us Iran-Contra. What do you see in store for President Obama in his second term?
I think the second term offers any president a real opportunity. It's because they can't run again. I always thought, for example, a lot of people here thought that if John Kennedy had survived for a second term, he would have removed J. Edgar Hoover. In fact, a lot of the people around him were saying that. I thought in his second term, Bill Clinton would have made a very serious run at reforming the entitlement programs, because he had won very easily and he had a strong mandate and he managed to fritter it away. I mean, you know, most presidents are going to be smarter than to get involved with a Monica Lewinsky. Most presidents are smarter than to do something like Iran-Contra. I hope, anyway. And I think that Obama is much more disciplined and unlikely to do something really outlandishly foolish like that.
Well, you mentioned President Kennedy and J. Edgar Hoover, and everything changed on November 22nd, 1963. In less than 10 months, we will observe the 50th anniversary of that day. I'm sure you remember it well.
I do indeed. I was then at that time running the Washington Bureau of the Gannett newspaper, when we got the message. First bulletin, 1 p.m., and it was fascinating in retrospect, because we didn't know what to make of it. We didn't know whether this was we weren't a society where we dealt with things by assassination ordinarily, and we didn't know whether this was an aberration or whether this was some kind of a larger plot that would affect other people. We know that, you know, Secret Service people went immediately up to the House of Representatives and surrounded the Speaker, who had become second in line. And we had several hours of very uncertainty about what was involved here. And then as gradually, you know, we got enough information to feel a little reassurance.
Well, his death, President Kennedy's death, brought the presidency of Lyndon Johnson to fruition, and you're a fan of LBJ, who has a complex legacy.
Yes. People ask me who was the best president of my time, and I say, well, probably LBJ, except for one thing. The one thing was the big thing, the war in Vietnam. But I do think Johnson was a very capable guy, and he had the right instincts, was trying to do the right things, but he had this one blind spot. He didn't see how damaging the war was, and continued to promulgate it long after he should have done it.
We'll be back in 90 seconds and talk a bit more with Jack Germond, also slated to hear from Will Bennett and Kevin Seitz and much more. 297-5633 is your number. More after this 1.5 minute pause on WRKF. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. 877-217-5757. Jack Germond, who became famous with the McLaughlin Group. And when I say became famous, he had been toiling in journalism for about three decades when he started appearing regularly on public broadcasting stations across the land, including the one right here in our backyard. And Jack, as you've noted, there's nothing like television to validate you as a personality. I'm sure everywhere you went, whether you were on an airplane, on a street corner, somebody said, hey, there's Jack Germond.
Yeah, it was the most trivial thing I did professionally over the years, and yet it was the one thing that people knew about. And they judged you on it. People would say, you know, I love your work, Mr. Germond. I would say to myself, you don't even know my work. My work was what appeared in the newspapers I worked for. The blathering on television was just blathering on television.
You said it was the most trivial thing you ever did.
Yeah, it was. But it paid well, you know.
Well, shows like that have become less common in recent times, but McLaughlin Group, in many ways, was a trailblazer as far as having a few conservatives and a few liberals sitting on the same set and yelling at each other for 30 minutes.
Yeah, that's true. I must say, Bob Novak and I were the counterpoint of that show, and people didn't understand is that although we disagreed vehemently on a lot of issues, Bob and I were very close friends. And I admired him. He was a very fine newspaper reporter. He's a little cracked on what his conclusions were sometimes, I thought, and told him so. But he was, what we had in common was our newspaper work.
Well, yeah, I'm sure there are some folks who thought that after the show you went backstage and started some fisticuffs with Mr. Novak. In contrast, you probably went to some watering hole with him.
You've got it exactly right. Yeah. We were. I miss Bob a lot.
I'm sure Bob would have had a lot to say over the last few years, though. I doubt that he would have been a big fan of President Obama.
No. But he would have. He would have been more thorough in his reporting on what Obama's doing than a lot of the other conservatives that are writing columns these days. And he was a thorough reporter, and he drew conclusions from a lot of his reporting that I thought were mistaken. But I don't think he ever dogged it. He did work.
We talked about LBJ before going to the break. I recall a quote attributed to President Johnson. He said, I know when Novak's around, I can smell him.
Yeah. The little secret there, of course, is that Bob's wife, Geraldine, had been a secretary to LBJ. So I suspect that president looked at Bob Novak as a guy who stole one of his able secretaries.
Well, the appointment of John Kerry as Secretary of State, what is your read on this?
I think it's a great move and a very logical one. I mean, Kerry has been preeminent in this field in the Senate for many years, and I think he is an excellent person for that job, and will, the policy is going to be made by the president, and I think Kerry understands how things work. He's worked with a lot of presidents for a long time, and I think it'll work out very well.
What about Chuck Hagel?
I don't understand all this. I don't understand all this arm waving and screaming about Chuck Hagel. He has said some things that were not very careful, perhaps. But in fact, a lot of people have referred to the Israeli lobby as a Zionist lobby or a Jewish lobby or something, and use the language carelessly in a sense. But it doesn't mean anything. It didn't mean that he was anti-Israel. And the fact is that there's a lot heavier debate inside Israel about the government's policies than there is in this country. And I think he's... I like the idea that he had all the experience he had in various ways in his life to make him a defense secretary. And I remember, you always have to remind people, the policy will be set by the president, not by the Secretary of Defense.
Well, the vote will come soon, and in a few moments we're scheduled to hear from a gentleman, William Bennett, who's a board member for Americans for Strong Defense, who's against Chuck Hagel. Do you think Senator Hagel will be confirmed?
I think he will be confirmed in the end, yes. It'll be close. It won't be like Kerry, but I think he will in the end.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace, please be brief. Phil, you're on with Jack Germond.
Good morning, Mr. Germond. Yeah, my question to you is, what do you think of the way the filibuster is being handled now? I know that there was some move to change it and to make it lower than 40 votes needed to end cloture or to end the filibuster. Do you think it was a good thing? It would be good to change it, or what's your opinion on that, sir? Thank you.
Well, I do think it would be a good thing to change it in a substantial way, because the way it is now, you just have a couple of people can hold up the whole process in the Senate. But I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think the minority is going to surrender the power they have and enjoy now lightly. And they, one of the things they have the power to filibuster is legislation to change the filibuster. So I don't think it's going to happen, to tell you the truth.
Well, Jack,
it should.
Jack Germond, belated happy birthday, and here's to the next 85.
I'm looking forward to it, Jim.
Well, thanks for joining us.
We'll both be here for a while.
Yeah, I'm counting on it, so we'll talk soon. Thank you, Jack.
Take care, Jim.
Take care. 297-5633 is your number, and we switch gears. We'll stay on the topic of Senator Hagel as the candidate for the nominee for defense secretary from President Obama. And we're joined by Will Bennett, board member for Americans for Strong Defense. Good morning, sir.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having us on the show. We appreciate it.
And you're not to be confused with the other William Bennett.
No, sir. I was asked that quite often when I was in my teen years, if I was related to the Secretary of Education. And I said no, but I think he's a good guy. And today, you know, we're here talking about Secretary of Defense and Chuck Hagel being nominated, and I got to tell you, we've got some real concerns about his positions and policies regarding the Defense Department and what he wants to do and present to the president as his plan for downsizing defense, and that's really a big concern considering we're in a time in our history when there's a lot of people that don't like us that aren't really concentrated in one particular area. We're completely out of a Cold War style conflict where we had two major superpowers who you could really kind of focus strategy on. And it just doesn't seem to me like a good time to be talking about a significant downsizing of our military.
Well, is that the only issue with
Senator
Hagel?
Not. He's got about 20 years of policy statements that he's made when he was a senator. That really talk about things like nuclear defense. He's part of a group that exposes its belief that we should have a nuclear-free planet by 2030, and that America needs to lead the way by getting rid of its ICBM capabilities. And he also, with that group in a paper he wrote, talked about making sure there was a 24 to 72-hour waiting period to respond to any nuclear attack on the United States. And while I think most people in the world who are fairly saying they would really like to see the eradication of nuclear weapons, you know, the reality is when you've got North Korea with approximately 10 nuclear weapons that are capable, active, and able to be used at this point. We've got Iran aggressively pursuing the acquisition of nuclear weapons, and both of them with long-range missile capabilities. That's just not something that's realistic in the short term, and I don't think even in the next 30 years. And as more and more nations try to enter the nuclear arms race and us getting rid of our ability to respond to nuclear attacks, that just doesn't make a lot of sense to me from a security perspective. And then, obviously, he's got some issues, in our opinion, on his stance with Israel. And, you know, when he's making statements about Israel ceding 40% of the West Bank, he's really putting it out there to say he thinks that the Israelis are the problem when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian relationship. And I haven't really seen much come out of his office or from his statement saying that the Palestinians need to be the ones to really step up and limit the attacks, stop the terrorist bombings, stop the missile attacks. And he seems to put most of the onus on Israel. And the policy part that I see as an issue is he's saying that we need to appease the Palestinians. And he kind of went along that same line talking about Hezbollah when Israel was fighting against Lebanon with the numerous rocket attacks they were receiving and the clear threat to Israeli sovereignty.
297-5633 to get in with Will Bennett, board member for Americans for Strong Defense. And before we go to the phone lines, Will, tell us about your organization. What is the genesis of this group?
Well, it's a group of folks that have come together because of our concern about Chuck Hagel and his policy positions. And that's really where these folks have come together from.
So the group did not exist prior to Senator Hagel being nominated as defense secretary.
Exactly. This was all about Senator Hagel's nomination because we feel his policies are going to weaken America and his position on policies. And while the previous guest you had, you know, he spoke very correctly that the president makes the policy and the defense secretary has to execute that policy. On the other side of that, the defense secretary has a lot of influence over which types of policies are more actively pursued by the president. And while the president has the obviously the last say, and it's their presidency, the Secretary of Defense is an important cabinet member in formulating that policy and presenting the different you know, pros and cons for a given policy to the president.
Will Bennett is our guest, and he is with Americans for Strong Defense. Dan downtown. Good morning, Dan. You're on the air.
Good morning, Mr. Bennett. In order to maintain the strong defense that you promote, do you believe that there's no free lunch anymore? We need to at least rescind the Bush tax cuts in order to pay for a strong military.
Well, I don't really have a position, and our group doesn't, on the Bush tax cuts per se. We believe that responsible budgeting in the DOD is required. We have to have a better way of spending those funds and get rid of the fat that is in there and the bloat that's inherent in the Department of Defense. Our challenge is in the 30% that sequestration will put into play, where you have $600 billion being cut from the defense industry over 10 years. And the current Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, he has stated in Senate testimony that those cuts, that 30% cut, will result in a hollowed-out force. And he went on to say that we would have a greatly diminished capacity for defense of America. That's a main concern of us. You know, when we're looking at cutting, yes, let's get rid of some of the contractor stuff that goes on that's really not, you know, beneficial. Let's get rid of the pork barrel spending, the earmarks, the specialty contracts, keeping manufacturing lines or certain weapon systems open that really don't do anything to help our national defense.
John in University Terrace. John, you're on with Will Bennett. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning. You know, I'd like to know about what your guest's opinion on Hagel's policy of his status of being the drone czar and his advocacy of drone use in U.S. foreign policy, be it legal or illegal. And I'd be happy to take my answer off the air.
I'm actually on that particular issue. I'm not familiar with his position on drones specifically. I think I remember reading that he was somewhat negative about the use of drones. I think drones are the future of warfare. The challenge that we come into from a national defense perspective is, you know, what's the appropriate moral and ethical utilization of drones? You know, there's been some critics that say they result in summary execution without any type of due process and sometimes hit U.S. citizens. And, you know, there's critics and opponents on both sides, and I think we've got a serious debate on our hands on how to effectively employ drone technology. in future conflicts.
Now, you're a warrior, having served in combat, and so is Senator Hagel. There have been defense secretaries who have taken a hike when wartime occurred during their respective generations. Are you impressed by his military service?
Certainly. I mean, this group is not taking away from his service at all. He served honorably, received, I believe it was 2 Purple Hearts. He was a sergeant, served a year in Vietnam. So, you know, he's been there and done that. He served his year in time. You know, when we look at current warfare and current policy and strategy, it doesn't really relate quite so much to a sergeant, you know, working on the front lines and serving honorably in Vietnam. We're looking at post-Cold War outside of the two superpower types of strategies, and I feel that some of the policies that he's proposed really go back towards, you know, a Cold War style instead of really the diffuse enemy that we face today and multiple threats and hot zones that are flaring up throughout the world.
Andy in Goodwood. Hi, Andy. You're on with Will Bennett, Americans for a Strong Defense.
Good morning, Mr. Bennett. First of all, I'd like to know who funds you guys. And two, apparently the citizens of Israel don't share y'all's concern, seeing as at the last election that they had, I guess, last week, Mr. Bibi barely held on to his coalition government, being defeated by more moderate folks who feel like making peace with the Palestinians was the correct way to go. So why is it that Americans are trying to impart their will on the Israelis?
Well, I don't really see us in trying to impart our will on Israelis. What our group is looking at is the overall policies of this nominee. Who, you know, he's been in elected office. He's made positions. He's done votes on these things. Israel is one piece of the overall policy. And when we're looking at how we treat our allies, that's an important thing. And if we've got our Secretary of Defense saying it's good to go to Iran and have open talks with them with no conditions, that they back off on their aggressive stance towards Israel, as they've said they want to eliminate or eradicate Israel off the face of the map, that's kind of a big deal to us. We think that if we're going to be standing by our allies, and this isn't just Israel, we need to stand by them. We need to show that we're going to be fully committed to their safety and security. And if we're going to engage in talks with folks that are other nations in the area, it needs to be with the condition that understand we're allies with this country, and your hostile actions towards that country are not conducive to us having a relationship.
And who is funding Americans for Strong Defense?
There's it's a 501c4, so there's anonymous donors, and I know people really love that, but you know that's what the law allows for to keep people from having, you know, reprisals and other things that can come through when they take an opposite position to an administration or other political figures. And you know, we've got just a fairly large group of concerned folks who wanted to make sure this message got out.
We'll be back after a brief timeout with Will Bennett from Americans for a Strong Defense. He is opposing the nomination of Republican Chuck Hagel to be the Secretary of Defense under President Obama. Back after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with Will Bennett of Americans for Strong Defense. And Will Bennett is a man who has practiced what he preaches. He served 12 years in the U.S. Air Force, supported operations in Bosnia, Kosovo, and Iraq, won the Air Force Commendation Medal with Bronze Oak Leaf Cluster, Air Force Achievement Medal and Army Achievement Medal with Bronze Oak Leaf Cluster. And he is opposing Chuck Hagel as the Defense Secretary under President Obama. He Senator Hagel, is a Republican. Some are saying that the president's trying to reach out and make this a bipartisan endeavor. What's your response to that compliment to the president?
Well, you know, when we look at who the president's nominating, personally, I don't really see a R or a D after whoever's being nominated for Secretary of Defense. That needs to be the best person for the job, regardless of their political background or their party affiliation. Needs to be someone who's going to be looking at what are the strategies to ensure the security of this nation, and also our, you know, our ties with our allies. I mean, America is a superpower still, and we have other threats in the world coming up. So I want to make sure that whoever is nominated is going to be the best person for the job at this time. I think Chuck Hagel has a lot of good qualities. He's a very hardworking public servant. He's done a lot of good for this country. I just believe his policies are off center for what we need at this time in our nation's defense.
Now, there are other groups, including the Log Cabin Republicans, who are opposing Senator Hagel because of his insensitive remarks in the past about gays. He was an opponent of Ambassador Hormel, who was on this show, by the way, about a year ago. Do you have any qualms about those stances, former positions taken by Senator Hagel?
Well, when we look at the new force, you know, you can't really say things like that and expect our diverse members of the military to really fall in line. I mean, we have a lot of gays in the military. They serve just as well as heterosexuals. And whether there's don't ask, don't tell, or there's acceptance or not, you know, they're there serving right alongside everybody else. And, you know, the Secretary of Defense really needs to take the position to where everyone's inclusive, everyone's service is value, and be supportive of people who are out there serving, and then execute the policies of the president. So it's probably not the best thing to do, even from a larger overall political sense, to disparage a certain demographic of the United States.
Final call for Will Bennett, and then we'll go to Kevin Seitz. Will Bennett, you're on with Dorothy from Goodwood. Hi, Dorothy. You're on the air. Please be brief.
Good morning. I was wondering why this group thinks they can have it both ways with Chuck Hagel. You're complaining about his stance on Israel, but you're commending him on other policies that he may have. I'm not sure exactly what you mean when you oppose his nomination for one thing, but you're commending him on other things.
All right. Would you respond, Will?
Certainly. I mean, when you've got someone like a senator who's had to vote on many, many different types of policies, ranging from defense to foreign affairs to domestic policy, you know, that there's so many different things that our legislators work on that, you know, I don't think Chuck Hagel is a demonic guy that we need to vilify across all lines. I just think that his policies as they pertain to national defense don't work in the current threat situation that we're in. He's talking about sequestration is good. Let's go ahead and cut that 30% because his quote was the defense budget is bloated. Okay. Well, if we hollow out our force, that's not good for what we need now. If we take and remove nuclear weapons off of all nuclear missile submarines, that doesn't help us in our strategic placement when we have the rising threat from Iran and the existing threat from North Korea that's also working hard to develop long-range nuclear missiles or nuclear-tipped missiles that can reach the west coast of the United States. So, you know, those types of policy issues are really what we're against. It's his specific issues regarding defense that are problematic in our mind.
Well, thank you, Will Bennett. I asked the previous guest, Jack Drummond, if he thought Senator Hagel would be confirmed. He said yes. What do you think?
I think it's going to be a close vote, and I think right at this point it can go either way. And if people are in agreement with us that Chuck Hagel is not the current or the right person for this time in our history, National Defense, please contact your senators and let them know before the vote.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Thank Will you, Bennett, okay. Americans for a Strong Defense. And we're joined now by Kevin Seitz. He spent the past decade covering global war and disaster for ABC, CNN, and NBC, among others. And his latest work is The Things They Cannot Say, stories that soldiers won't tell you about what they've seen, done, or failed to do in war. Previously, Kevin wrote In the Hot Zone. Good morning, Kevin Seitz. Can you hear me, Kevin?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay, that's better.
Good morning.
All right, well, in your book, you focus upon warfare, and speaking of warfare, I'm sure you heard some of the previous discussion regarding Senator Hagel as defense secretary. Matters of war continue to be polarizing in this country of ours.
They sure do. But the message of this book, I think, is something that we can all get behind. I mean, the fact is, Jim, we're failing our soldiers, Marines, and other service members in how we're treating them when they come back from war. We're certainly giving them the proper respect. You know, that's changed a lot since Vietnam. But we need to engage them in a way that helps to bring down these military suicides and other reentry problems that we're seeing with our military men and women as they come back from war zones in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, as you probably know, suicides among military service people in 2012 outpaced the number of combat deaths in Afghanistan. There were 349 suicides and 295 combat-related deaths in Afghanistan. So that's almost one suicide a day. Statistics from the Veterans Administration say that there are 1,000 military suicide attempts every month. And out of those, usually one succeeds. So it's a difficult situation. And this book, I profile 11 soldiers and Marines, and these are guys that I had been deployed with, that I spent a lot of time in war zones in Iraq and Afghanistan, 7 deployments to Iraq, 5 to Afghanistan, met them in the battlefield, and I followed them home to see where they were. And a lot of them were in pretty bad shape. But the idea here was to help them unburden themselves, to tell the stories that they need to tell that are difficult to tell to a society that while they're willing to serve and give up their lives for, they don't completely trust with their war experiences.
Well, Kevin, what do you attribute the primary culprit as far as the soldiers coming back who are having these kinds of challenges that result in them, in some cases, taking their lives and in other cases trying to?
Well, this is an interesting development right now. For years, we've looked at post-traumatic stress disorder as an indication of witnessing trauma that was just overwhelming to us, that it made it difficult to continue to live a normal life in the face of what was witnessed or experienced. But now the Veterans Administration has done a new study, and it's called Moral Injury in the Context of War. And it's beginning to look at the greatest PTSD indicator as guilt rather than necessarily having witnessed something traumatic. Now, that guilt can come from having taken a life, having killed in the line of duty, whether justified or not. Sometimes it comes from having taken a civilian life by accident or even killing your own guys in friendly fire. But there's also the guilt of having survived while your friends haven't. Now, if this indeed is the case, there's good news here because it means for the most part, we as human beings do want to do the right thing. And when our war experiences or other things that we experience go against our moral compass, we feel something and we become conflicted about it. So the treatment for that is really about helping these men and women forgive themselves. Now, they don't need to be forgiven by us. We sent them out there to do this job. But for the most part, they have to be able to forgive themselves. And so we have to learn how to listen to their stories, get them to talk, and help them to help us take part of that burden away from them, to shoulder that burden and begin to allow them to have a complete and full life again.
The book is The Things They Cannot Say from Kevin Seitz, who is a war reporter. In one of your chapters entitled Killing Up Close, it opens with a quote, "I'll never tell her what things I did here. I'll never tell anybody." War is not pretty, is it?
No, it's not. And that particularly is kind of a sad story, Jim. That's a story of William Wald. He was a Lance Corporal in the Marine Corps. He was a member of the 3-1 India Company. And I met him during the Battle of Fallujah in 2004, Operation Phantom Fury. And I actually did a videotape interview with him almost immediately after he had just killed six insurgents within a Fallujah mosque. They had been firing at the Marines from the mosque. They attacked it, and they took them out. And he just began to tell me everything that was on his mind at that moment, all the things he was feeling. Obviously, there was an adrenaline dump that happened to him. But he began talking about friends that had been killed, his own experiences and feelings. And one of those things was, he said, "I'm proud to serve my country, but I'm not proud to kill people." And it just was this kind of candid interview that I've really never experienced. I've been covering war for a long time. And for someone to be that honest and to reveal their heart to me, was an interesting proposition. And I lost track of Willie over the years because I kept on covering war. He went home at one point, and I tried to catch up after looking at the videotapes I had of him again, and what I found out was that he had died. He had come home with a serious post-traumatic stress disorder, also traumatic brain injury, and the treatment for him ended up being a cocktail of different drugs, antidepressants, sleeping pills, and so on. And that seemed to make things worse. And then he also began adding to that his own methadone that he was buying from the street. And he overdosed at one point. And, you know, it was a sad story. But what the legacy that he's left behind us in this video and the interview that he did with me is so instructive for young men and women going into service and for all of us in the community to really begin to understand the complexities of the war experience. It can be absurd, it can be funny, it can be thrilling, but there are also things that really inspire guilt within these young men and women, and that's what we have to really address here.
How did the experiences of war affect you as a reporter?
Oh, they affected me greatly, and in fact, Jim, it's the reason that I was inspired to write this book. You know, I covered war for a long time, but the most disturbing aspect for me was not what I saw, just as, you know, with these guys that I talk about in the book, but they were the mistakes that I made in the course of reporting from these war zones. Now, I won't detail them now because it would take up the entire program, but in one incident, my failure to put down the camera and help someone actually led to their murder. So that filled me with guilt, and it actually created some symptoms of post-traumatic stress within me, insomnia, hypervigilance, destructive behavior. And one of the things that happened, though, as a journalist, I had to continue to write and to do speaking engagements and tell my story. And what I realized is that when I shared honestly what I went through, it began to mitigate some of these symptoms. And I thought if it worked for me, it can work for these soldiers and Marines. And so I went out and I found some of the guys that I was with, and I crossed generations, and I talked to Vietnam vets and Gulf War vets and even a Dutch sniper and an Israeli IDF soldier.
Now, one of the things that has changed since Edward R. Murrow was reporting in World War II is that the technology has given you more of an ability to cover these kinds of stories. How did that affect you when you were in these war zones?
Well, yeah, it really has, and it's kind of been the basis for my career. I started out as a traditional network news producer working for ABC News, NBC, and CNN. And at a certain point in my career, I got in the middle of a firefight, and I actually videotaped it myself, and I kind of began reporting from that point on, but I began reporting as a one-man band, shooting, editing, and transmitting my own stories. And then in 2005, 2006, I went to work for Yahoo News, and I did a project called Kevin Sites in the Hot Zone, where I covered every major war in the world in 1 year to kind of look at the patterns and consequences. And I did it alone. I had a series of producers back in Los Angeles, where Yahoo was based, but I traveled alone. And that new technology allowed me to shoot and edit and transmit the stories from every place from the Congo to Sri Lanka, as well as, you know, the wars that the U.S. was involved in Iraq and Afghanistan. But I traveled all over the world, 20 different war zones, and that wouldn't have been possible even a few years earlier.
Well, Kevin's work is displayed and his story is told in the Things They Cannot Say, stories soldiers won't tell you about what they've seen, done, or failed to do in war. Kevin Sites, we thank you for joining us today, and I understand you're joining us from an unusual vantage point. Where are you?
Well, I'm coming at you from Hong Kong. It's night here. It's going on 11 here, and so yeah, a little bit different time zone. But I'm certainly happy to talk to you, and I appreciate the time you made for me. If I could just say that if you're audience is interested in finding out more about the book, they can go to www.kevinsitesreports.com. There's links to that, but it's also available at all your major booksellers.
Thank you, sir, and congrats on a fine work. Kevin Sites.
Thank you so much. Take care now.
The Things They Cannot Say. Today is the 90th anniversary of the birth of one of the great writers of any time, Norman Kingsley Mailer, born on this date in Long Branch, New Jersey, January 31st, 1923. He died in 2007. His wife, Norris Church Mailer, who was a writer of her own renown, died in 2010, shortly after appearing on this show, with her memoirs, much of it about her life, of course, with Norman Mailer, who wrote what may be the best war novel of all time in 1948, his first work when he was only 25 years old, The Naked and the Dead. 3 days away from the Super Bowl, and we will talk about this tomorrow. And we're hopeful at some point, Kevin, of reaching the elusive Jake Tapper, who was going to be with us for a bit today, but got called to be on the desk at CNN. And, well, okay. We'll talk to Jake soon. And thanks for listening, everybody. Thanks to Bob Mann for a fine job yesterday, too. Until tomorrow, for Kevin, I'm Jim. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.